Welcome to Books and Booze. We're here with Joe Clifford, author of Lamentations. This is Renee, and I'm drinking a Cupcake Vineyards Pinot Grigio because my doctor told me I couldn't drink beer anymore because of the calories and the sugar and whatever. So she suggested wine for Books and Booze. Joe, how are you doing? How are the Giants doing, and what are you drinking?
The Giants are up 3-2. It's in the seventh inning. I've got a chat open with Tom Pitts and Bill Baber and Rob Pierce. I've got the sound on from the Giants because I can't stand listening to Joe Buck. But I got the game on, so it's about 10 seconds behind. So I've got the radio, the game, and a chat, and I'm talking to you guys. And I'm drinking coffee. I don't think I need coffee right now. My pulse is going through the roof.
Coffee's the right choice.
Yeah.
Jessica, what are you drinking?
I am having a Blue Moon Harvest Pumpkin Ale, and it is so delicious. I worked really hard today, and I really earned it.
You did. Do you want to share, or is that, like, off limits?
No, I will. I will a little. My son's kindergarten, their whole school, the elementary school, has decided that for Halloween, the kids can dress up, but not in their Halloween costumes. They have to dress up as what they want to be when they grow up. So I've spent the day, he decided on police man, which is simple enough, but there was, no costumes, out there. I found one. It was a size too big. He's going to have to deal with it. So basically, I had to run out at the last minute to go to Halloween stores and try and find an actual costume again. I've already been working. Yeah, we've been working on his zombie costume all month long. That's ready. But no, I was not prepared for costume round two. So I'm a little bit frazzled myself today.
So yeah, I guess we should just jump right in because I don't want to keep Joe from his full attention being on the World Series any longer than necessary. But you know, real quick though, I will say one thing. One of my best friend's dads had a ticket to an executive suite box whatever today, and the airline fucked up and he didn't get to go.
Oh,
that's a terrible story. I went to Game 3. I had seats. So it's pretty remarkable going to a World Series game. You might have seen my picture with Steve Perry.
Yeah,
I saw that.
That's Steve Perry.
Yeah. You know what the lead singer from Journey, you know what the worst part of that is now that every time I hear a Journey song on the radio, I can't change it. I feel compelled to listen to the whole song.
You must.
So I had to listen to Open Arms today, Faithfully. You know, anytime, any way you want it, anything that comes on, I have to listen to it now. I feel like I've got a bond with Steve Perry, so.
You do.
Just showing you that he had no, you know.
I have to say that when you posted that picture, Tom Pitts made a little pun about when he dies, he'll sing Don't Stop Bereaving, and I thought that was the funniest thing ever. I love that. I'm a huge fan of puns anyway, so. Shout out to Tom. That was a good one.
Well, I'm glad we got the Tom Pitts reference out of the way right away because I always have to figure a way to work him in. Tom's Canadian, and that's pretty much what they do. You know, they make puns and they apologize. That's sort of their MO.
Well, it works.
Oh, what's the other one? Process. Every time he says process, he says process. It always makes me laugh. The writing process. Yeah.
That leads me to our first listener question then, since Tom was mentioning, he would like to know why you didn't go out with us last weekend after Lit Crawl.
Oh,
well.
I don't know why he couldn't just ask you, but he submitted that as a listener.
I'm getting worse and worse as I get older, my phobia of being out in public, and I make a joke of it, that I stay inside the house, but I really stay in the house for a reason. I had to go out 4 weekends in a row, 4 nights, Friday, Saturday, and Friday, Saturday. And it takes a toll on me. By the time Lit Quick rolled around, I'm kind of coasting on fumes, not to mention, the body stuff, which is I went to the doctor today, and he says it sounds like I have a degenerating disc in addition to the degenerating hip. So there's the physical pain of being out. I mean, it's not that, I mean, you know, the first thing I asked him was like, am I, you know, like stuck in a wheelchair someday? He's like, no, it's just a matter of pain. So, you know, the pain part you can deal with, because life is pain, right? That's the Princess Bride. Anyone who tells you different is selling something. It's, you know, at the end of 4 days of being out and trying to put together lit crawl and lit quake, and the PA's not working, and, of course, baseball's going on, and I got these body things going. By the time I'm done, I'm just like, I'm going home, you know? I can't do any more of that. Hey, what's up? How you doing? Oh, yeah, it's great. Nice to see you. Let's talk about stuff.
I'll tell you what, too, my husband was such a good sport. He came out even though he had been, like, on a job thing that gave him, like, I don't know, like something like 4 hours of sleep in a week. And he came out, and then we ended up stupidly staying out so late that, like, we had to, like, stop in a parking lot and take a nap on the way home so we didn't crash. So.
Yeah, that's...
So you might have been
right. He was a champ to go to. I mean, I can only imagine as the non-writing spouse going to these writing things. It's bad enough being a writer getting sucked into these. Being the spouse, they should get a special award. It's like, you know, I mean, one thing we can say is like, we're at a reading, but we're doing it. You know, we're writers. Like, what excuse do they have besides they just love their, you know, husbands or wives, which makes them kind of heroic, really.
Yes, I agree.
And your wife is such a supportive part of the readings that you put on.
Yeah, I mean, my wife's a doll, and she's a terrific, wonderful woman. You know, she likes the stage part of it. You know, she's not so big on the planning part of it. You know, the stuff behind the scenes. Which my first thing about my wife is that when we have a house party, like, you know, we have 25 people coming over our house, I will spend all day cleaning the house and cooking, because I do all the cooking and cleaning, getting everything ready. And then the second somebody shows up and rings the doorbell, my wife will put on an apron and greet them. That's kind of what she does. So, she looks fabulous in the apron, mind you. Nobody, you know, she really likes the presenting part of it. But there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes of the lit quakes and the lit crawls that are just tedious, and they really drain you, you know.
I can imagine, yeah.
The couple of times that we've done the Books and Booze live readings, it's been like I had been quit smoking for a year, and I bought a pack of cigarettes for the one in San Francisco, because I was just like on the verge of an anxiety attack, like 3 days up until the end.
It's tough. I mean, you got to put on a public face, and it's just not what we do. I think as writers, we're just naturally more comfortable behind, you know, a computer screen with make believe people and make believe problems that we create. Like the real world stuff is just, it's harder, especially with a reading series. You know, the Books and Booze thing, you got to coordinate and talk to people and people to show up, and you get hobos and the crowd heckling you, so it's not an easy night.
Joe brings up the heckling hobo, but he neglects to mention that he was the hero of the evening. He was the one that called the guy out and found out that he was like a bitter drunken poet.
Oh, I felt so bad about that. I was so mean. That guy didn't deserve that. I told him to go back to the shelter. I felt terrible after that. It was like, geez. I mean, I used to be that guy. Like, that was just a shitty thing to say. I was really upset. And I'm trying to read, and it's a new piece I'm reading, and he keeps heckling. And he's heckling everybody. So by the time it got to me, it's like you're on your last nerve, and you're just waiting for that one more thing to go, you know, and then you're just ready to snap. But I felt terrible afterwards. I mean, he probably had a wet brain. You know, he's like living on the street. I just snapped. Not one of my finer moments. So I feel pretty bad. I mean, added to the other things I feel bad about. I mean, I feel bad about a lot of shit. I mean, it's not my list of things I feel bad. It's not like tour. I mean, I've completely ruined lives. Like, that's down the bottom of things I feel bad about. But it's still on my list of things to feel bad about.
Well, sure. But see, I didn't mean to like hit such a dark spot so early in the show.
No,
I feel bad.
It's not.
You said.
You know, if this wasn't a game right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
See, if this wasn't game seven right now, I probably wouldn't be so touchy-feely, but I'm really emotional because it's game seven, you know? It's like, this is game seven. This brings up stuff from, like, when I played baseball. All I wanted to be was a baseball player. I didn't want to be a writer or an artist. I just wanted to play baseball, but, man, I could not hit. I could not hit a baseball
to
save my life. I had a beautiful swing. Yeah.
Wanted to what, Jessica?
Well, you live.
I wanted to be a baseball player. I mean, softball, I guess.
The Midwest. It's kind of on tradition in the Midwest. I mean, what else does there do, really?
It is. I was the
Midwest
Catcher.
Oh, good. There you go.
I think everybody, every kid wants to play baseball at some point.
There we go. That's two outs. You know, that's the thing. When you're talking, you have kids, and so, and you get to that whole thing where you tell them they can be anything they want to be, and I always kind of cringe when I'm like, I mean, every day I tell my son, Holden, that I'm proud of him, and he can be anything he wants to be, and I try to do that because that was never done for me when I was a kid. But at the same time, to be anything you want to be is always, I always feel like I'm being slightly disingenuous because, not everybody gets to grow up to be an astronaut, right? I mean, that's just
right.
How it works.
It's true.
It's actually a demotivator. I don't know if you've seen demotivators. It's a website with all these posters. Yeah, so instead of like teamwork, but that one is, I think it's like ambition or something. It just shows a picture of French fries and says, not everyone gets to grow up to be an astronaut.
Oh,
I like that.
I think anybody who like is on my Facebook for longer than like a week will witness one of my rants about how like nobody is actually entitled to be working a job that they enjoy. And that if you're working a job you enjoy, then just shut the fuck up and keep working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if I had to trace back my drug problem to one single thing, that would be it. It was having to work a job I didn't want to work. And I never got over that. And I really think that was probably the impetus for my journey down the dark path there. I could not handle a 9-to-5 job, a job I hated. And now that I get to do this, what I love to do for a living, it's hard not to wake up and feel grateful and blessed every day, even though I'm a miserable kind of person, because I get to do what I want every single day.
Right. So speaking of which, we're going to do it backwards, I guess, because we kind of brought it up. This is a huge release. Your previous books were with small presses. This is with a bigger press. This is like being featured in Publishers Weekly. You got the hardcover and the cool book cover and all of that. How does it feel now that the book's out?
Allow me to snatch, Get Set Go, to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. You'd think it would be a great thing, but the first night this book is out, I finally get to go to a bookstore, right, and do a reading. And for the first time, I don't have to show up with my own books, because up until now, small press, you got to order your books. You show up in a little bag with a, traveling writer hobo, and you bring your books to the bookstore. This time, the bookstore orders all my books ahead of time. So I just show up like the big shot author. I show up, and there's, 40 books on the table, right? 40 hardcover books, and I'm feeling great. A lot of people show up. But a lot of people also already bought the book, right? I mean, they've bought the books. I've been pestering them for the last year. And so I don't sell nearly 40, which means now I'm left with the prospect of having them return these books to the publisher, which would look even worse. So I coordinate. I worked out a deal where I bought the excess, and I ended up taking my books home with me anyway. But I mean, there's a whole, when they print 5,000 hardcover books, that stuff's expensive. It's not like the nice thing about print on demand, with the smaller presses is, you want a book, you just order it and they print it on demand and they send it to you. With this, they have to gauge ahead of time how big of a draw you are, and if you don't sell those 5,000, like, your career's DOA. Like, that's, so this is, it's like anything else. It comes with a whole bunch of perks, and then there's a whole bunch of headaches. The other thing too is it's, a hardcover. I just saw Chuck Palahniuk at the DNA Lounge. Fantastic. But his book is selling for the same price signed that mine is. Like, I don't set the price. I can't compete with the guy who wrote Fight Club, and I shouldn't even be talking about that because that's the first rule. But that's what you have to deal with. You have a whole new set of rules, and it always seems a lot cooler until then. Once it happens, you just realize it's like just a big pain in the ass that you have to navigate now and deal with. But yeah, it's great. I have a hardcover book. I'm not complaining. I'm complaining because I complain all the time.
The part of that situation was because the Amazon pre-orders were pretty okay, right?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm doing well, and I can't. It's the white people problem thing, right? I mean, the Louis C.K. bit, I mean, I had a hardcover book. I should just shut the fuck up. I had a hardcover book. It's great. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I have my hair. I'm walking, and I have a hardcover book. And the Giants are up 3-2 in Game 7, so it's a good life.
There you go. So we're going to be getting live score updates, which the people who listen to this won't hear until Friday at the earliest.
by then they will know. But right now we are in the eighth inning, and the Giants are up 3-2. You will hear the jovial tone in my voice, like, it's kind of whimsical almost. Like, if the Giants were to lose, you will hear a very sad, sad author replace this current incarnation. So let's just hope we get through this while they're still ahead.
Right. That's why I'm like, go Giants, even though that is that's serious business in my family. You're not supposed to say that. What's funny is, you know, my husband's British, and he was like, why doesn't he just DVR it? And I was like, Like, if you are in the city that one of the teams is from during the war, you know who wins at the end. No matter what you do, you know who wins.
Yeah, if DVR, you can't DVR a baseball game. That's, you know, you just can't do that. So, but I understand that. I also am a big football fan. I'm, you know, alpha male. That's what I do. I mean,
you're a 49ers sports. Fan, aren't you?
I'm a huge 49er. I reckon I'm wearing my 49ers T-shirt right now because my Giants T-shirt is dirty.
And
the sad thing is, actually, I'm a Yankee fan. I know. I saw the picture. I wasn't meant to comment on it. It was just a great picture. Yeah, red. Nice red 49ers jersey.
That's why we get along.
I'm a big Steve Young fan. I'm such a huge Steve Young fan. I remember being in rehab. This was in, I guess, 98. I was in rehab. I'd been there like 2 weeks, and somebody had a paper, and I read in the paper that Steve Young retired. I was like, fuck this, I'm out of here. And I walked out of rehab. I'm like, I'm going to get high. I can't do this anymore. Steve Young retired.
Oh my God.
No, no more. Yeah. I mean, in all fairness, it didn't take much for me to relapse. Maybe like, oh, wait, the wind's blowing. I'm going to get high.
Yeah. I'm sure Steve Young would be really upset to know that, so we won't tell him.
Isn't he Mormon?
He is.
I think he's a Mormon. He was a quarterback. I like Steve Young more than Joe Montana, which you can't really say in San Francisco. I just liked him as a player. I just thought he was a gutsy, you know, ballsy player. He didn't slide. You know, he took the hits. He was just a man's man quarterback, you know. So I just liked him a lot. He's my favorite player.
I mean, I liked him a lot, too. But, I mean, Joe Montana was Joe Montana.
Yeah. I also got here in 1992, which was when Young had just taken over. So,
okay, I can
see
that.
You know, it was a little, everything coincided with, you know, my arrival here. Yeah, good timing.
The time was right for that.
So we're almost halfway through the show without actually talking about anything to do with your book, other than the fact that it's released in a hardcover. So, wait, like the quickest rundown, the super condensed version. The book is about a guy who's kind of a non-starter. His older brother is a junkie, which is, I guess we expected something, some angle, right? The older brother's accused of murder, and the protagonist, Jay, feels like he's got to get his brother to turn himself in so things don't get worse. That's the basic, most basic rundown of the book. Obviously, there's a lot more to it. I feel like there's a couple things going on here that I want to know about. This book is about it's got drugs in it, which, you know, we know, like, Junkie Love and a lot of other stuff. It takes place in your home state?
Not my home state, but a home region, New England.
Okay.
I changed it from my home state. It was Connecticut. I wanted a darker, colder, more that Russell Banks affliction territory, so we went to northern New Hampshire. But it's based on my hometown in Connecticut. Anyone from you'll recognize the land. If you were from my hometown, you'd recognize the landmarks like the crane in the pond and those kind of things.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
I guess my big question, just like, you know, being somebody who's read your earlier work and reading this and kind of knowing that you went into this book with certain intentions about how it was going to be done, were there a lot of things in this book that were as personal as the stuff that was in Junkie Love, or did you really try to distance yourself from this?
Well, Wake the Undertaker is a big distance from Junkie Love. Those are two completely different ones, just fantastical, you know, fiction, far off. There's not much to connect those two. It's different in tone, different in everything. And in a lot of ways, Wake the Undertaker failed. I'm not just basing that on, you know, sales just so much as the response from people who like my work. And with Lamentation, it was a conscious effort to bridge the gap and get closer to the Junkie Love style. I'm big on audience. I think you have to listen to audience. And if the reaction you're getting isn't what you're looking for, you know, you have to start looking at it. You know, it's everybody else isn't insane, right? I mean, if there's a disconnect happening. So there was definitely a conscious effort to return more to the Junkie Love gritty, real, raw sort of the tagline from the
right.
Service West that I use. But at the same time, I mean, I'll probably always talk about drugs and low lives in that world, but I also wanted to do something different because if you're not stressed, you know, stretching as an artist, you're sort of stagnating, and that comes across in the work. So it's a small town. There's a plot, much more of a plot. Junkie Love is sort of an interconnected stories. This is a straight-up plot mystery. I wanted a page-turner. I'm a big, if you follow me on Facebook, and I'm a big fan of Gillian Flynn's work, and that's really what I'm striving for, that sort of, you know, pop-boiler, pop culture, popcorn, mainstream mystery with enough of an edge to attract the cool kids.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's what I liked about it, is that it had all of the elements that you expect from the mainstream thriller. You know, that you go into Barnes & Noble and you go to the mystery section, you pull the book off the shelf. Like, you know, you kind of know what you're getting. But there was a lot of elements to this that were different, and there was, like, more of a, like you said, gritty, real, and raw. There were times where I feel like authors will usually, like, you know, close the door, or in the movie the camera will pan away, but in this book that didn't happen. And it still maintained a lot of challenging moments while being a page-turner and being just a genuinely fun book to read.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that's not in Junkie Love, that's in Wake the Undertaker and is in the new, the one I just finished, Occam's Razor, and Skunk Train, which we're shopping still, and Lamentation is my infatuation with brothers. I've always been keenly interested in the relationship with brothers for obvious reasons. My brother and I have been best of friends, and we've hated each other, and we've gone through, like, any time you have a sibling, it's as close as you get until you have a child of your own to another you. So in a lot of ways, I'm working through that and exploring that dynamic. And Lamentation is certainly, that's at the heart of the story, is two brothers and what, you know, the lengths you go to you know, what's loyal and what's broaching certifiable, right? I mean, there's a point we have
right.
to cut the apron strings. And then, but you also, you know, the Springsteen line, a man turns his back on his family, he just ain't no good, and from State Trooper. And Springsteen probably influenced, I mean, he did. He influences what I do more than any other writer. So, and that's, you know, these are just central small town themes, I guess. Noir, broken hearts, you know, lives not quite realized, I guess.
Yeah, I get, and I think it's hard to talk about this book because so much happens in that second half that you want the reader to have that moment of discovery all their own. But I think what you said about, like, the lives not realized and the relationships that Jay has with his friends, with his ex-girlfriend, with his boss, with his brother, there is all these loose strings and all these things that haven't really been resolved but still sort of hang over everybody. And I think that is something, like, even going back to my hometown, which isn't very small, it's not a city, but it's not a small town, you run into people and they'll bring something up and, you know, if you've been away, you're like, holy shit, are you still talking about that? It was like 15 years ago. But you realize that when you're there and you're interacting with the same people day after day, things that happened 15 years ago, if they haven't been resolved, they're still hanging around affecting the way people do things and the way people behave with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to break down in tears, if you've never left your hometown and you want to just break down in tears, put on Tom Waits' Whistle Down the Wind, and you can do that. You know, being stuck in that same town and not getting out when you've had bigger dreams and bigger hopes and still finding yourself within those walls. There's some people who stay in, you know, they stay in their hometown, they marry their high school sweetheart, and they're fine with that. But then there's the other kind of person who's always wanted to leave, and they haven't quite been able to do that. And I think that's Jay. You know, he knows there's something more out there for him, but he doesn't really give himself the permission to go after it because he feels a tremendous sense of guilt towards his brother. And that's you know, that's what governs his actions. And the, you know, the central theme, you know, or what's, you know, the storyline is he going to be able to get past that and get more for himself and his life and his family?
Right. I think it's, well, okay, I'm not going to say what I was going to say because it gives away something about the end. So never mind. but I think it's interesting because you do hear a lot of stories about people who, whether it's a brother or a parent or a sister or whatever, that get stuck in those cycles of thinking that they have to stay. And you do wonder, like, how much of that actually even helps the person they think they're helping.
You know,
in the case of Jay, it's not really doing anything for Chris.
True, and I've been on, the nice thing of having the experience I have is an ex-addict is I've been on both sides of that delightful coin. I've been the person breaking hearts, and I've been on the other side where people are breaking mine, which affords a unique perspective. And, you know, somebody's stuck around long enough for me to make a change, right? And yet there's plenty of people who can't quite make the change. So it's not quite as cut and dry as, well, you know, they're living their life that way and now it's time to cut bait. I think in a lot of ways Jay is justified to hold on because, you know, there's that saying in AA, which is, you know, wait for the miracle to happen. And I think it's true. I mean, people change their lives all the time. And I'm a perfect example. Tom Pitts is another perfect example. I mean, if you would have known us back in those days, I mean, you wouldn't be on the phone with us because you'd be worried you're trying to get your credit card information, and it happens that, you know, we made it out, and so people do make it out, and I think that hope is central to the novel as well, and whether Chris makes it or Jay makes it, you know, you'll have to read the book, but you know, I want that hope to at least be there because without that, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, what are we fighting for, right?
Right. I think, yeah. I mean, I feel that because, actually, you know what? I said this to you after I finished Junkie Love, is that it does someone like me who's seen a lot of people lose their lives to drugs and alcohol and crime and all that, it does me good to know that there are success stories. It's not just a completely hopeless situation. But then the other side of the coin is that, like, just the deep regret for the people who didn't make it, you know?
I have a lot of friends who are big into animal rights, and I mean, I love animals, but I'm not quite as big into animal rights as some friends of mine. And I will, anytime Michael Vick, you know, who's the quarterback for the Jets now, and everybody knows what Michael Vick did, horrible, horrible things to dogs. And anytime Michael Vick news comes out, a few of my friends, you know, they just go ballistic on Facebook. And the first thing I'm always thinking is, I did things worse than Michael Vick did. I really did. I did some horrible, horrible, horrible things, and I hurt a lot of people. And what I did, you know, in the grand scheme, if you're ranking, probably ranks worse than what Michael Vick did, and he did some awful things. And so I was given a second chance, you know what I mean? So it's really hard to draw that line somewhere, and what, how far is too far? How far do you go where you don't deserve a second chance? Because there's people who, if you would talk to them, you know, ex-wives, brothers, just plenty of people who will tell a very different story of me, and they will not be quite as willing to say, yeah, it's great to have them back. I mean, they harbor some serious resentment, and they're right to harbor resentment because I did some bad things, and I can't take those times back. And that push and pull of when is too late, and how much can you forgive, and how much can you put behind you, and how much can you rise above? I'm fascinated by that for apparent reasons.
I think that's really interesting given some of the developments that happened towards the end of the book, which obviously we can't talk about, but when you lay it out like that, and I think about, because I actually just, you know, I read the book a while ago, because I got a review copy, but then making the notes for the show, I was going through and flipping through and making sure I had all the character names right, and that I wasn't, like, completely making shit up about the plot, you know? And I ended up, like, rereading the whole last two or three chapters. And so now I'm like, oh, man, that's insane when you think about the situation that happened. So I'm hoping that maybe me being so vague is going to get people to go out and buy the book because it's really good. It is.
I mean, I also, you know, I want to write, you know, for all the other things about your life. I mean, I'm teaching a writing class now. I just taught one over at the Writer's Grotto, and we're talking about all the things that interest writers. And the things that we like as writers are all these little, you know, accoutrements, these details that we were talking about, you know, the central to our lives. So I'm exploring this part of my past or how this relates to the accoutrements, the window dressing. But what readers want, what readers pick up on is the page turning. It's holding interest and like, oh, wow, what's going to happen next? And so you never want to lose that part of the story, you know, for the greater you know, sense that what interests us is, I'm sorry, it's the eighth inning and then Madison Bumgarner's just popped out, so I lost my train of thought. But it was going to be something fairly profound, and it could have changed life, but hey, it's game seven, and we'll just have to leave it there.
All right. Fair
yeah.
enough.
You know, it's funny because I don't think this is giving too much away. The book has a mixed ending. it's happy. It's a happy ending in a lot of ways, and it's a sad ending in a lot of ways. And I think that it's realistic in a way that a lot of happy endings aren't, because it has that part that kind of hurts. So my question is that when you're building your book, when you're doing the outline, you're working on it, whatever, do you start with the things that you want to explore and then build the page turner over it, or do you do the opposite?
Well, I was really fortunate. When I got to FIU, Florida International University, for my graduate degree, I know not everybody needs to go to grad school. I really, really need to go to grad school. I just did not possess whatever that is to write a book. I could do scenes, but I could not make them add up to more. And the woman I worked with, Lynn Barrett, was just a master of plot. She just knows plot so well. And so, I learned a few tricks as to, to keep things going. And one of them was, I had a lot of, initially a lot of my work would be scene one and, Bob goes to the store and then he goes to see his mom. And what she instilled in me was this idea that Bob, goes to the bar, he finds out money's missing, so he talks to his old friend to recover, so there's this chain of events where everything's related. And I couldn't write it. She would make me write my synopsis, where everything was so related with so, and every time I had an and, I'd have to go back and make it linked together. So that really helped me, and that's always paramount in my mind as I'm writing. As far as how I write, I tend to have an idea. In this case, I was hanging out with a friend in grad school, and somebody had mentioned there was a two-parter. Somebody had mentioned they had to get rid of their hard drive and, electronic recycling. You know how that works. You bring your electronic recycling somewhere, and they throw away your computer for you because you don't want your computer just on the side of the road because it's got all your private information. And the other idea is that when Tom and I used to be junkies, we would see these weird shops that would just pop up for like 2 or 3 weeks, and somehow a junkie would have gotten inside a storefront, and he'd just be offering like electronic recycling services, which always was really funny to me because I know what they're doing in there. They're stealing identities. And YMB would bring, deal with these obvious tweakers was beyond me, but people would go in there. And so I combined those two ideas. Well, what if we have this hard drive and somebody who drops off a hard drive, not thinking it through, to somebody of Chris's, the junkie in the story of his nature, and let it go from there. And then, of course, I had the other ideas, pop culture. There were events happening in the country at the time that involved various scandals that I can't mention. But, I used that as a central theme. So that's where I got that. And what you do is you write a mess, you make a mess, you start writing, you make a mess, and then you go back and you fix it. You usually have a beginning, you make a mess, you get to the end, an idea of what you want for the end, then you have to go back and deal with that middle part, which is so tricky because everything has to be organic. It has to add up, and it has to feel as though it's adding up, and it's not just you want to get to the end. And readers know that. And that's the trick of writing, is those pesky middles.
I think it's funny you're saying that because I'm doing revisions right now, and I realized today that my protagonist, it's hard to explain, but one of my protagonists never meets the antagonist ever, and it's been built up through the whole story, and it just never happens. Yeah. And I was like, how do I write the whole fucking book without that happening?
I can tell you a funny anecdote that may not be as funny to you because it's probably not going to be the answer you need, but Les Standiford, who was the director of my program at Florida International, told this great story about his first novel, Zip to Zap. It was this idea about this, I forget the kid's name was Zip, I think his name was Zip, and he was going to Zip. The idea was basically that it was like a spring break thing, right? And he's causing all these troubles, and the sheriff is looking for him the entire time. In the end of the book, the big climax, he has the two passing each other in the street and not meeting. And he said that was the single biggest mistake he ever made in writing, because we have this like built-in idea. I think we want to protect our characters, maybe, or we just this natural conflict aversion. Maybe we just come from broken homes, so we want to avoid that sort of turmoil. But the fact is that's what writers, that's what readers like, is you want to get the mess. So my advice to you is to make sure they meet and don't make the mistake of Zip to Zap. You don't want them two strangers passing in the night, because you got to have them meet. Throw them in the middle, and see what happens.
Yeah. It just doesn't even make sense that they wouldn't meet. They're in the same building for most of the book. I mean, it's terrible.
No, but I understand. That's just what we do. We try to avoid. I think we're trying to, like, spare. I don't know. It's probably some deep psychological thing. I mean, if you went to a therapist, there'd be some conflict, you know, aversion, or, you know, goes back to your childhood or something. But yeah, you don't want to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Enough about me, because it's getting embarrassing.
Since we know advice, that's good.
Yeah, there you go. No, but since we know that you're a huge Gillian Flynn fan, and right now there's like three people who aren't, and fuck those guys. What I really loved about Lamentation is also what I really loved about Gone Girl, was being able to pull these things that happen in the national media over and over and over again. We're so familiar with the story. We're so familiar with how it works and how it goes down. And bringing that into a fictional universe and actually providing an insight into it, and maybe providing a reality different from the one that we see played out on the national news all the time. And, like, to me, reading Gone Girl and reading Lamentation, they both do the same thing with different types of cases. That's intimidating to me as a writer, but it's so fucking cool as a reader. So when you're writing that, do you feel like there's a weight, like, man, I better handle this carefully, because if I screw this up, you know, people are going to be knocking down the door? Or do you just have to go into it with the idea of, go ahead?
Yeah, I certainly don't write trying to, I remember my, I keep talking about my graduate, you know, when I went to Florida International, I fucking hated that program. I really did. I hated my time there. I had a motorcycle accident. I almost died. My wife left me for a friend of mine. It was a miserable time. But now that time has gone by, more and more I appreciate that school and what they did for me. So sorry if all my stories involve FIU personnel. But James W. Hall, who was another writer down there, said that when he read Silence of the Lambs, he was filled with both a sense of euphoria and immediate depression. Euphoria because, wow, that's amazing. And then, you know, depression because the bar had just been raised that much higher. You know, that's how I felt when I read Gone Girl. So, I mean, I don't try to quite, you know, that's the Mount Olympus of what I'm trying to do. So, I mean, I don't compare myself in any way to writers that good. You know, she's just beyond what I can do. I mean, when I read book, I was like...
I meant as far as taking that thing that the public is so familiar with in the news, where, because the particular case that this is obviously drawn from, I think when people read the book, they're going to know exactly who it's about, exactly what it is. But on the flip side, it's something that's played out every couple of years, something like this. It's the national news. Same thing with Gone Girl. Every couple of years, there's a really pretty missing woman, and, you know, we're looking at the husband and Nancy Grace and all that horseshit. So... We really hate Nancy Grace in our family. So anyway.
Who likes Nancy Grace? One of life's biggest mysteries is Nancy Grace. I mean, this is going to sound terrible, but I'll just say it. But out of all of life's mysteries, the fact that somebody had sex with Nancy Grace to produce children is probably the highest on my list. I can't imagine anybody in an intimate moment with that face, because she's probably the ugliest just human being I've ever seen. I can't stand her. Anyway. Enough about Nancy Grace. The question was I don't worry about that. I think, one, you're probably over giving people too much credit. I don't think a lot of people get that. In fact, I know a lot of people who read it don't even pick up on that. The comparison you're talking about. Yeah, and the other thing is that, no, I mean, you give yourself permission to just, I mean, that's what you do. At some point, you just have to trust what you do, and I mean, I have the same insecurities as everybody does. I mean, you write in your first draft, you're like, I'm stupid, and then you get to a point like, this isn't half bad, and then you go back like, oh my god, I'm stupid. So I mean, that never goes away. But there's only so much you can do. If you're gonna write a book, you got to write the book, right? I mean, what?
And that never goes away. You're always gonna feel like an idiot. That's great.
most of my day is spent trying to convince myself I'm not a moron. So I don't know, maybe there are people better than I am.
Probably not.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are people more self-confident. I mean, my self-confidence is so Yeah, and I'm such a cliche when it comes to addicts. There's a saying in AA that's called the piece of shit at the center of the universe, and I'm the quintessential piece of shit at the center of the universe. Like, somehow it's all about me, but I'm worthless. So I don't know how that works, but that's how it works. But at some point, yeah, even I can pull back and be like, okay, this is what I do. This is, you know, I remember reading a piece for lip service in Miami when I started that, and the guy was swimming the English Channel. And it was a great line in the story. And he was talking about getting up at 4 in the morning and having to go swimming and not feeling like, I'm not, in the line, the mantra he told himself was, this is what I do, this is who I am. And I'll say that a lot. I mean, this is, you know, it's like the twist Tom's always talking about on the gangster picture, right? This is the life we chose. This is the life we chose. This is what we do. So good or bad, right or wrong, fail or succeed or, you know, attain a middling level of success, this is what we do. And at some point you have to say, okay, well, I'm doing it now, and we'll see what happens.
I'm gonna throw a couple of listener questions at you really quick.
Sure.
Well, first of all, Nick Corpin asked a bunch of questions you already answered, so that's awesome. He wanted to know if your process changes when you hear back from the audience, which we've covered. Then he also wants to know if Steve Perry washed his hands before high-fiving and if you have washed your hands since.
Steve Perry, I do not believe, washed his hands. I believe he came straight from the stall, and I have washed my hands moderately. I won't say vigorously. I mean, maybe more of a cursory is a gesture. So, there you go. We're in the bottom of the ninth now, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Whew, yeah. And this is actually, if they win, this will have been tremendous because I think I would have probably had a heart attack. There's a good chance I would have had a heart attack if I'd not been slightly distracted with our conversation.
Well, that's good, well, then. I'm so glad we were here for you.
Yeah.
Are you still ahead?
I take sports really, yeah, 3-2. I take sports really seriously. This brings back 2001. I just gotten sober. I mean, I just cleaned up my life, and I just started watching baseball and the Yankees and Game 7 against the Diamondbacks, and the Yankees lost, so this is a chance at redemption. I've had really good life luck. My life luck has been amazing. My sports luck, however, has been terrible. I mean, I guess you'd rather have it that way, right? You'd rather have great life luck than shitty sports luck. The other way around. But I'd still like to win this game. This would mean a lot to me.
No, I understand. So, I understand. My husband is a Bears fan, so I know about bad sports luck. I get it.
Oh.
Yeah.
I know that this happens. Yeah. I'm a 49ers fan, though, so, you know, we always win.
Yeah, I know. I'm a Yankee fan, a 49er fan. How much can I complain, right? I mean,
exactly. You're doing fine. Even when we lose miserably, I'm like, yeah, but
I know.
Still a 49er.
I'm running out of things to complain about. It's terrible.
Yeah, geez. Eventually, you're going to have to be happy with your life.
I know. I am. You know, the sad part is, the truth is I really am happy. I think I just got so used to doing this miserable thing that it's just comfortable for me. But when I stop and think, like, man. Considering where I was, you know, 15 years ago, literally in the dumpsters, you know, and in jail and all that stuff. It's like, man, this is a, you know, pretty nice turn of events.
Yeah, I think we made some, like, progress tonight.
I think we've done well. I mean, I worked with Dr. Goldberg on Monday, so, you know, I'm pretty primed now for, you know, introspection and reflection and personal responsibility. And
you're susceptible to what we have to offer here right now.
Yeah, I want
to. This is redemption, man. That's all Books and Booze is about. It's redemption.
Yeah.
If nothing
well,
else.
Well, you know, there's one story a man writes, and this is another thing from Lynn Barrett at FIU, but I can't remember. There's one thing a woman writes, a woman author, and I can't remember what it is. But the one thing the man writes over and over again is fall and redemption, pretty true. All my work seems to deal with fall and redemption. That's the theme. You know, fall and coming back from from the brink, which is just something that fascinates, I think, America especially. You know, it's that Rocky syndrome of taking your hits and still getting up. There's something heroic about it. So.
And I guess
we are 1 hour away, just in case you guys were wondering. You may get a shout when they win. I hope I can maintain my my enthusiasm, but I'm just letting you know there's a good chance I may not be able to.
We got like 10 minutes left.
There's 10 minutes left, but there's one out left. I mean, there's one out
in
the game.
Yeah, that's it, man.
I know what you're saying. So, with that running in the background, because I'm not going to say with that aside, because that's dumb. When I know lip service started in Florida, right, at FIU.
Yes, Andrea Askowitz had a reading series called Lip Service. I desperately wanted to be a part. I hadn't been published. I hadn't had anything done. I sent a story in, an excerpt from Junkie Love. She rejected it, but we talked, and I ended up. That's how I wrote Junkie Love, was through Lip Service, because in order to get these pieces, I had to. I had this tendency to just write these really, just.
Did we lose Joe?
Sorry. Yeah, we lost Joe. We have a run on.
Happening in the game, yeah.
We have a runner on third. Ty runs
awesome.
On third base.
Okay.
Wow.
Very
pretty
excited.
Nuts. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so did Lip Service. I had to shape the pieces to have a beginning, middle, and end, and that helped me keep get an idea of story and structure and not be so, I love Kerouac. My next kid is going to be here in February. We're naming him Jackson Kerouac. I'm a big fan of Kerouac. But he does not very, he's not a very plot-centered writer, you know. So, it helped me to focus, my craft into the beginning, middle, end, and have an actual narrative arc, which is what people look for in the work.
But my question, I guess, is like, how did it get out here? How did you take it on and make it something that's happening up in Northern California?
Well, after I left South Florida, I'm not a South Florida guy. That's not what I do. And I couldn't wait to get back to San Francisco. And so when I got back here, I've been here for a few months, and I really wanted to start a reading series again. I missed it. I missed that. There's a certain, thrill that comes with doing that. And I asked Andrea if I could use the name, and she said yes. And I took her, her same format, which is 1,500 words, true stories, and just gave it a more of a San Francisco bent, which is a little more, darker, a little grittier, a little more alternative. If you look at their website in Florida, it's all turquoise and teal. And, if you look at ours, it's all, black and red, and there's a bug splatter on the windshield. So I made it very San Francisco, and that was what I wanted to do. And
It seems like it's gotten a really great reception in San Francisco. Like people show up, which is saying a lot for any reading series.
Yeah. Well, the trick is that you always have every reader, you say you got to bring 10 people. So that's how you do it. You have 5 readers, you're guaranteed 50 people, right?
Yeah, guaranteed. That's why the Books and Booze events are always like packed house, standing room only. So now I know you said you've got Skunk Train out there trying to find a home, and you just finished Occam's Razor, is that?
Occam's Razor, which is,
We heard a little bit about Skunk Train the last time you were on the show. What can you tell us about the new one?
Well, Occam's Razor is, I based it on the story of Brian Taylor. Sorry. Hold on. Keep going! Giants win! Giants win! Holy shit! Man, I can't believe I did a whole interview with that. My God, I thought I was going to die. And my heart is going so fucking fast right now. And I'm trying to answer your questions. Holy shit. Fucking A. Man. Wow. Okay. Whew. Jeez. All right. Whew, man. Okay, what are we talking about? That was a strange circumstance. My book. Oh, yeah. Wow. I can't believe they won that. Holy shit, man. I feel like I need a bath. Okay, so, yeah, Occam's Razor is about Brian Taylor was the number one draft choice of the New York Yankees back in 1991. Could throw the ball 98 miles an hour. And amazing pitcher, came from a very poor background at the time. He won the single largest signing bonus, $1 million. His mother, like, held out, and it was a big deal at the time. Anyway, a couple years later, he's plowing through the minor league ranks. Don't worry, the story is not about sports. It really isn't. It's just peripheral. I just like this story. And so he goes home after his, I think it was second season in the minor leagues, and his brother gets in a fight, and Brian goes to stick up for his brother, throws a punch, and he throws his shoulder out. All of a sudden, 98 miles an hour is now 92 miles an hour. People are hitting him. He's out of baseball in a couple of years. Last I heard, he was just arrested for crack distribution. He's in prison, right? I just love this idea of being good at one thing, especially sports-related, because it's such a particular skill set, and then having that taken away from you. So in my story, it really doesn't have – it's not about sports. I just have a guy who was used to be a football player who blew out his knee in a fight over a girl. And so he's got that burden. And now he works in sports security, an ESPN kind of gig doing security. And his boss, the woman who got him the job after that accident, calls him and says that she wants him to investigate into the wrongful conviction of her stepson. So that's the impetus behind that story. And it's really, it draws a lot on one of my favorite novels, which people can't believe, but it's Wuthering Heights. I love Wuthering Heights, the adopted son and that dynamic, family dynamic. It draws on, you know, just a little bit of sports, but it also takes place in Miami, which is sort of a reconciliation for me because I had such a miserable time in Miami. But Miami has its own particular set, you know, of you know, details that come with it. When you live in Miami, it's just, you know, every region carries its own characteristics. I'm big on setting being a character. And so Miami is very much a character. And that's what this story is about. I think it's, you know, I think it's every time you finish a book, you feel like it's the best thing you've done, but I really think it's the best thing I've done. And it's much more lamentation than lamentation is. I mean, in terms of a page turner, pot boiler. I'd read Dark Places by Gillian Flynn, and when I got done, I was like, boom, I got it. You know, and it happens like that. So not that I borrow anything from her. I just saw what she was doing, and then I realized that putting a murder mystery central like that, where it's just that's what the book is about. It's about this mystery and making that at the forefront. Whereas lamentation, it's more characters going on, and there's, you know. But this story, it's really the mystery that drives it, and I think that it makes it much more compelling, and then you can do the other things you like with, you know, in terms of character, because, you know, you still have to have strong character, because character drives fiction, but the mystery is even, I think, even more at the forefront here.
Cool. And then, now, is this Tom Pitts just fucking with us, or is there really some kind of a chance of a Lamentation sequel?
No, they want a Lamentation sequel. And the thing is my agent wants me to write it, and the publisher wants it, but I wrote a sequel to Wake the Undertaker before Wake the Undertaker was published. No one's ever going to see this sequel. So before I write a sequel to a book, I want to see, one, if it sells, and two, you know, I want to know they're going to buy it, because if I write this thing and they don't want it, I'm stuck with a book that nobody's going to want, because one publisher's not going to pick up another publisher's reject, you know what I'm saying? So before I sign on to it, I kind of have to see the Lamentation goes where, and I think it's going to go where I want to go. I have the arc for the story. I think there's more I can do with Jay. I have the whole plot line, you know, mapped out in my head and on paper, and I just want to make sure that it's not for naught. Because, you know, you're writing a book, you know, it's a good 6 months of your life, and when I write a book, I'm, you know, I see you later, wife, see you later, kid, and I just go down to my basement and I kind of check out for a few months at a time. And before I do that, I want to make sure that there's, you know, there's a reason for that, and that being that somebody's going to publish the thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was so thrown off by the whole, like, Giants winning in the middle of our interview. I don't really know how to end this. We're kind of out of time. Congratulations to all the Giants fans out there.
That was just amazing. That was like, so much stimulant, you know, it's like, you know, I remember when Tom and I, we used to shoot, like, coke, heroin, and speed all at once, you know. The whole body was going like, ah! Like, you know, you're going left, right, you're going up, you're down. I mean, it's sort of like this, you know. You got the interview, you got the baseball game, so everything's all happening at once. It's a little bit of a sensory overload. I mean, the coffee is not quite as tense as the old days, but, you know, I'm 44 with a bad hip, so, you know, life changes,
Like I said, that's the end of the show. We are we're once again being sponsored by Miss Massacre's Guide to Murder and Vengeance, which we've said many times before. It's a fucking great book. And right after you go out and you buy Lamentation and you read it, go out and buy, or buy them at the same time. But
at the same time, get that Amazon free shipping if you buy them.
Craig, did I make any fucking sense during this interview? I'm curious to get this thing edited. Okay, all right. I'm just curious about how it comes across.
I get it.
All right. I'm just wondering. I mean, it's just like, what the fuck is he even talking about? So good. I'm glad it worked out. Thanks for having me. It was awesome, and I hope to do it again. Thanks for the press and all that stuff. And
loved
awesome.
It.
Go Giants. Okay. Thanks so much, guys. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Cool.
All right.
Have a good night. Music. Music this week is Exile Reunion by Kelly Lattimore, and I hope you enjoyed that, and we'll be back next week with David James Keaton, right? Or did I make that up?
Nope, that's true.
All right.
I love that guy. All right.
Yeah, oh, great guy. Can't wait to talk about
funny
the book.
Funny guy. Looks like a Batman villain. And my kid has all these books with, like, Batman villains. They all look like David James Keaton. I'm not kidding. Every Batman villain in all my kids' books look like David James Keaton. I'm not even joking. Anyway, you guys have fun.